I am Sharad Kutan. Welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. I'm in Penang. It's a very sticky, sweltering Penang, where the Georgetown Literary Festival has brought together and curated some amazing conversations. And today I want to bring you some of those highlights and some, you know, interviews with people that I've met in this festival. Now, with me is Uma Pagan, Ambike Pagan, of course, well-known host of BFM's evening show, and an ex-colleague of mine and a good friend. And I'm going to turn to him right now. Uma, thank you so much for being with me.
Pleasure.
Okay, so before we get to the question of Anwar Ibrahim, who came and had a very frank, I think, discussion with Bernice Chorley, the director of the festival, and your thoughts on that, because I want to get your thoughts on that. The issue of the festival itself. You yourself have a festival your own, the Kuala Lumpur Festival,
yeah.
Very successful, a festival of ideas. This is very different, it's very literary, or a little more literary, but it's quite a mix. So what are the highlights for you at this festival?
So this festival this year had an India focus, which I feel was quite interesting because, as you can see from behind us, the state of freedom is the theme. And of course, India is going through some stuff right now. I mean, there are a lot more extremist voices coming to the fore, and the democracy is experiencing something quite interesting. And so for me, there were all of these panels on Indian democracy, on partition, on where their politics are at the moment. And I found that very, very fascinating because, you know, as a casual observer from the outside, what's the first thing that people talk to you about when they talk to you about India? It's world's largest democracy. That's the line, right? That's the cachet that they've used for generations. And if you don't follow it closely, you just know India as the world's largest democracy. But there's so much more context and nuance, and they had all these great Indian authors and journalists talking about those things. So for me, that was a big highlight.
Yeah. In fact, one of them is Salil Tripathi, who's written a book, he's written several books, and he's covered Malaysia as well. He has a book at the festival about the Bangladesh War of Liberation, 1971, and its present resonance, or the important, how it continues to be important. History is a very important part of some of the discussions here. What else were you struck by in terms of this festival?
So there are, as you mentioned, a lot of literary elements as well. And one of the individuals that I had the honor of speaking to was a gentleman by the name of Sion. And Sion, if you don't know, he's Icelandic. And he is a collaborator with Björk. He's been nominated for an Oscar for writing music. He is a novelist, he's a poet, he's a playwright, he's a screenwriter.
It's a very small place, Iceland.
That's my point.
And was he on the football team as well?
He might have been.
For the World Cup?
But here's one of the most interesting things he told me. There's 300,000 people, right? And he said, if you count history, there are probably maybe 800,000 to a million people in history who have spoken the Icelandic language. And he says, for the first time in decades, Iceland is experiencing immigration. And he thinks that immigration may be the key to saving Icelandic culture and language.
It
blew my mind because we talk about immigration in such an opposing way. We're like, oh no, they're coming here. They're going to dilute our culture and our language. And he's like, no, we're a small people. There's a real concern that our language and our culture will die.
Yeah, you know, I had a fascinating discussion with Jean-Christophe Ruffin,
right,
who a French doctor, author, diplomat, you know, in many ways trying to help shape the policies of France to accommodate these new realities, some of them the result of immigration, either from North Africa or more recently with the Syrian refugee crisis. Very important conversations coming from Europe, as you say, also this wonderful focus on South Asia and India in particular. Did you gather anything from that, that the theme of Malaysia? Malaysia, of course, was also, Malaysia has to be.
It has to be. The state of freedom,
And our freedom, and I think we kept going back to the fact of May 9th, and maybe it's time to talk about Anwar's appearance at the festival.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
So, for me, Anwar's appearance was an Anwar Ibrahim appearance, in that Bernice, the festival director, was hosting him, and she asked very pointed, very difficult questions. And they were questions that were in many ways expected, but his answers were also expected. I mean, if you know anything about Anwar Ibrahim, I think he knows how to structure a response based on the audience he's speaking to.
Okay, so and I must say, you know, because he was
I'm not saying I don't believe him.
Yeah, okay.
I think he genuinely believes the response he was giving at that particular time. But, you know, after speaking at Georgetown, he was heading over to the mainland to give, I think, 5 events, charamas and lectures. And in my mind, I kept wondering, what is he going to say there? Because this is a liberal, middle-class, English-speaking audience, right? What will he say to a Malay-speaking audience? Would it be the same thing?
Yeah, and I guess politicians will speak to differently to different audiences. I do think what was interesting, because Bernice begins by asking him about his childhood and growing up,
yes.
And the fact that, and he characterized his family as kind of middle-class Malay of a particular period, and his parents clearly a love of literature and reading,
yes.
And had all those books in their small little library. So, you know, something that I think shapes the way he speaks now. Also, I think, you know, the intervention that we had from the audience, because of that delay, we were doing that little gig on the stage, was Muhammad Haji Saleh,
yes.
Who said, okay, he's a politician, and that's one thing, but there's this other thing about Anwar's contribution. He's a man of literature. Now, I'm going to try and bring snippets from Anwar's talk later on, but some of your concluding thoughts about the other things. There was the queer dimension to the festival. There's the slam poetry and the revival of a, especially among young people, of the spoken word.
Yeah.
I mean, did you have access to any of that?
I went to a poetry recital on Saturday afternoon, and that was very, very interesting. And yes, so Georgetown Literary Festival has always had a very strong focus on poetry. And of course, I believe part of that is also because Bernice is a poet herself.
Yeah, Bernice is the director.
The director, right? And she loves poetry. And I think this is one of those avenues where people get to experience all of these things in one place. So, you know, we have a lot of these things happening in KL, right? But they're individual events. And I think Georgetown Literary Festival is that one place once a year where you can actually, it caters for all of your needs and desires. If you like poetry, you go see the poetry stuff. If you like food writing, you go see the food writing stuff.
Do you like poetry? Honestly.
No, I do like poetry, but I don't believe all poetry is as accessible to me. I'm not one that can actually savor it in the same way or even critique it in the same way that I do film or literature, right? I don't think I'm good enough. I don't think I've read enough, but I enjoy listening to it.
Ah, the listening and the performative elements of poetry is also something that the festival does. I mean,
I don't just mean spoken word or slam poetry. I mean even poetry on the page. I enjoy listening to the written poet recite his or her own words. I think that's very fascinating when you hear it in their own voice. I think that's kind of cool.
Okay.
So,
and any last thoughts? I mean, were there people that you met at the festival that you found interesting or fascinating?
Yeah. I mean, for me, Sion. Just as Icelandic author who's like a man, like he's a true Renaissance man, and I was in awe. I mean, I had breakfast with him before the session, and I was like, I could spend an hour talking to you about film and Kurosawa and Dashiell Hammett, and he's just so incredibly smart. That was very cool. But for me, like you said, going back to what you said about how Malaysia was a theme that was running through the festival, I think that's something that we need to remind ourselves in Malaysia Baru. And throughout many of the sessions I went to, people kept bringing up the same point, and Dato' Sri Anwar said it as well. Remember, what happened on May 9th, it was a bloodless revolution, and the people are to thank for that. And there was a lot of effort, and you should applaud yourselves. And for me, the addition to that is, yes, I would like to believe what Anwar Ibrahim said, but I think it is our role to hold him accountable to those words and to hold the government accountable to those words. So it felt like a reminder to us, the people, hey, what happened on May 9th? Pretty big deal. Maybe we should like hold ourselves, both carry ourselves up and be proud of it, and carry on doing what we did that day.
Wonderfully put. I mean, this is why you're host of a radio show.
And this is why you're host of a TV show.
Maybe.
Let's just pat ourselves on the back.
Okay. Well, we'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. I'm here in Penang at the Georgetown Literary Festival, and my next guest is Leila S. Choudhury. She's an Indonesian, a journalist, and award-winning novelist. Very excited to have you on my show. Can you tell me why you're here? I know you're a journalist, you're a long-time journalist with Tempo. Now you're retired, you've got a book, you're a writer. What is it about the festival that made you want to come?
Well, thank you. this is my second time to come to Penang. The first time was 2014. And I kind of like the city because it's very different from the rest of Malaysia. I've been to Kuala Lumpur several times. I like the food, but mostly I also like the setup, yeah, and the people. So besides the festival itself, I really like the place. So that's why I
Okay. So Penang's often said, and you've heard it over and over again, mm-hmm. that it's a kind of an oasis in Malaysia for freedom and for, you know, civil society, activism and speech and so on. I mean, in Indonesia, where you're from, are there similar spaces and festivals that have become a site for honest conversation and engagement and encounters?
Maybe I could think Bali. It also has a Ubud Writers Festival. It became sort of an oasis for people who do not want to be disturbed by a lot of people who misunderstand whatever they want to say. But actually, after 1998, we have this honeymoon period where everything is very free. But at the same time, I also mentioned in the panels, one of my panels, I said that there's also a growth of conservatism and also the growth of a lot of groups. So now we have a democratic country since 1998, a democratic government, and then we have changed administration many times with an honest election. I'm talking compared to 32 years of New Order, of course. But the challenge of writers or challenge of anybody who wants to speak democratically is much more from the society, from the groups of conservative people who are maybe sensitive about certain things. And also the other challenge is the use of blasphemy law, the use of undang-undang ITE, you know, whatever you said in the internet, although that may be one just mean to criticize, but that can be, you know, pushed to you know, something that is insulting. So that's very, I think it's very threatening and scary.
Right, so this is, you know, for us a very important parallel. I mean, Indonesia had its breakthrough, yes, a moment 20 years ago.
Yes.
We borrowed the terms of our
reformasi,
own.
Yeah,
yes, because it was reformasi total, yeah, in Indonesia. Yeah. We just took reformasi, not the total.
Yeah,
but now that we've had our breakthrough moment, yes, you know, it's 6 months into this new government.
Yes.
Some of the leaders are the same and you'd know them. Anwar Ibrahim,
yes,
you know, have of course had an engagement with Indonesia. As you, as a,
yes,
journalist at that time at Tempo, what were your thoughts and how did Indonesians respond to Anwar and his message that point?
Well, I want to go back a little bit because Dr. M, Pak Mahathir was also popular in Indonesia for a while. During New Order, a lot of people liked Mahathir Muhammad because he's very outspoken. And they call him the Bung Karno kecil, or, you know. And I interview him several times during the New Order. But yeah, after what happened to Anwar Ibrahim several years ago, I think it was 1999 or something. Of course, because Anwar Ibrahim have a lot of friends in Indonesia. So we really sympathize and empathize with what happened to him. I immediately sent someone, a journalist, to come here to be able to interview him. Of course, at the time, my journalist said, well, you know, I could interview Wan Aziza, but for Pak Anwar Ibrahim, it's very difficult. And I said, well, try to give a written question, and then ask his lawyer, and then maybe, you know, with luck, maybe he can give us answer. And then apparently he did.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
You did get your answer. And you
got written, and then it's written by hand, and then we took pictures so then we can put it, you know, on the cover that this is a reel from him, but we also transcript it, you know. So it was very sad for us, you know, to see all that, and of course we both know, you know, Prime Minister Mahathir then, and also Anwar Ibrahim, It was very sad. Actually, you know, for the sake of the journalistic thing, we also sent someone to interview Prime Minister Mahathir that time.
Right.
So both.
So the Malaysia of the last couple of years has produced great stories for the world, yeah, including the story of the former Prime Minister Najib Razak and his wife. And I know the Indonesian press did, in fact, focus on that, right? Yes. The extravagance, yes, that was said to be the lifestyle of that, yeah, couple. Yeah. How did the Indonesian press respond when Najib fell from power?
Well, we felt in a way it's about time, because we actually expect that it should have happened before that, you know. It took a long time, because we remember there was a very big demonstrasi, yeah, a really huge one, but then, you know, he was still there, he was still strong. So after this it happened, but then we kind of questioned, you know, the collaboration of Mahathir Muhammad and Datuk Sri Anwar. We were wondering, you know, like, how did it happen? Well, actually, we do know, but, like, we were just wondering.
But what do you think, it was an act of political maturity, especially on the part of Anwar Ibrahim, you know, to put aside old grievances?
Of course, yeah.
Did it raise, Anwar Ibrahim's, in the estimation of Indonesian, especially the chattering classes are interested, yeah, in the Malaysian, yeah, story, that this was a man who could rise above his own personal grievances and find an alliance?
I think so, but we are very curious about what will happen in 2 years, you, okay, know? Like, yes, for sure.
In 2 years, Dr. Mahathir is going to be 95.
I know, but...
Okay, I want to ask you this, because of course at the festival I had Anwar Ibrahim as a guest. You were there when he,
yes,
gave you. So what was your takeaways from that engagement he had with the festival director, Bernice Trolley?
Well, you know, I talk, because although I'm retired, I still write for Tempo. And then I told them, look, I'm going to this festival. Actually, I don't really want to write about it, but then Anwar Ibrahim is there, so what about if Anwar Ibrahim is saying something interesting, then I write it and say, oh, write it, it's up to you, whether you think it's, you know. So, okay, so when I was sitting there, and then when Bernice was asking childhood, and I was like, oh, I hope this childhood thing is not going to take up the whole 1 hour, you know, because if it does, you know, all the important questions that I want to hear.
Or the childhood story.
Yeah, that was at the beginning, remember? Right. Like, how is your childhood? I was like, oh my God, you know? So, and I was thinking, okay, I'm not gonna write about this, you know? But then, when she asked about LGBT, then that's it. I'm going to write about it, you know? And then she asked also about, okay, you know, your decision to collaborate with Pak Mahathir. You know, and then he answered, and that's it. And then I decided I have to write about it.
So you're going to write the story. There were other questions. So not just the question of the gay community, also the question of the Amante.
But
there was the question of the Muslim Brotherhood. That question was asked.
Oh, yeah.
And there was the question, I guess. Let's talk about the Muslim Brotherhood question.
I wasn't surprised, though.
So one of the things he underlined, if I understand correctly, was that he engages with everybody.
Yeah.
Engagement,
yeah,
is not the issue.
Yeah, yeah. Like he engaged with everybody, and he thinks that, you know, I know them. It doesn't mean that I just have to cut off my friendship. But if you ask me, I'm a member or not? No, I'm not. So he was clear about that. But I wasn't very surprised with the answer, because I never really suspect, you know.
But this is okay. So this is part of the talk. Of course, the other big story question was around his relationship with the Turkish president.
All right. Yeah. I know. That one. Yeah.
Okay. So, okay. Overall, you know, being at the festival, has it been worthwhile?
Oh, come on, of course, of course. For sure, this conversation with Pak Anwar, but also there are several panels that I was very interested in, that I think if we want to do that in Indonesia, maybe we also have to do it not necessarily in a central place like Jakarta, but it has to go somewhere.
Why would that be?
Oh, there's going to be a lot of people, you know, talking, and there has been a lot of ban to the discussions in Jakarta, usually either about 65, sometimes it's about LGBT. Well, the LGBT one was not in Jakarta, but Yogyakarta. So, you know, some people are very oversensitive. They think that there's something's going to happen, or they said, akan menular, you know, contagious, you know. So,
so Indonesia has its challenges too when it comes to having an open dialogue.
Yeah, in certain area, yes, in certain area. So here I was very glad. I don't know whether you can have that in Kuala Lumpur. Can you?
I hope so. I hope so.
Good.
Okay. Anyway, thank you so much for being
You're
in the
welcome.
Show. We're going to be back with more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. We're at the Georgetown Literary Festival, and the next guests that I have, Bernard Chorley and Brian Gomez. Brian, Bernard, thank you so much for being on the show. Bernard, you are a well-known film director, but you came here and you played a role as a translator, doing simultaneous translation for a session called Susa Jadi Melayu.
Yes.
Tell us about that session.
Yes, so a Malay phrase, bidan terjun. I was bidan terjun in the sense that I was forced in, or I volunteered myself.
You were parachuted in.
I was parachuted in to be the translator for a very interesting conversation. Susa Jadi Melayu, it's difficult to be Malay.
And, yes. and the people on the panel, where were they from?
Yes,
and
so it was moderated by a Malaysian, and on his left were two Singaporeans, one female, one male, and on his right were two Malaysians. So there were four men and one woman on stage, and I would say that, you know, Aidli Mosbit from Singapore, who's a Muslim, Malay, Singaporean woman, really sort of brought a very gregarious energy to it.
She stole the show?
In a way, I think she did.
Brian, do you agree? I mean, was this the person who stole the show?
I think so. I think she, you know, a sense of humor really came through as well. But I literally had no idea who was actually in the panel, but I was intrigued by the title, Susa Jadi Melayu.
Because some people would say it's actually Susa Jadi Bukan Melayu, but never mind.
But yeah, but I mean, that's what was intriguing about it. And so I literally said, okay, well, this is something I want to go and listen to.
What were your main takeaways from the show, though?
Well, I think I think most of them didn't really speak about the difficulties of being Malay, but rather the non-difficulties, as it were. So, you know, they were talking about the privileges that are accorded to the Bumiputra community, and even the Singaporeans didn't say that, you know, there were particular difficulties.
Okay, so they didn't really speak to the
talk. I don't think.
Okay, I disagree. I think I think there were some interesting points that came through. Actually, apart from the usual of sort of. Punching, going beyond boundaries. Actually, what I found interesting, the two Singaporeans who are minorities in their own countries, of course, have a different process of the difficulty of being Malay. So for instance, Aidli Mosbit, again, as a Muslim Malay woman, has to punch through and break through boundaries to create a voice for Malay women through the plays. You know, I'm a film director who creates very strong female characters, so I can really relate to Aidli's need and desire to create a platform where there are strong female voices.
But I think her point was mainly about being a woman and how her father influenced her. Yes. So it wasn't so much, I didn't get that it was so much about being Malay.
But there was, the moderator opened a question that was quite interesting, which was actually focusing on jadi, the word jadi. So to become Malay, and he sort of said, you know, is the idea of being Malay inherited within your genes, your skin color, etc., or can you be Malay by speaking Malay, by translating Malay to English, English to Malay, by adopting Malay customs, by adopting Malay traditions? Can anybody be Malay, become Malay? So I found that Quite an interesting question. It could have gotten deeper.
Yeah.
And be more interesting. The other thing I suppose that was quite interesting was Hang Tua. Hang Tua was referred to
three times
and someone from the floor also brought it up. And it's interesting that even in 2018, any discussion about Malay identity still refers to that strong figure that clouds over us, which is Hang Tua.
You know, one of the things, because, you know, Brian, you're a musician, you have this wonderful space in Petalingjaya that, you know, where performances are, but you're also a published author. And I'm wondering, in that process of writing, or, you know, you, when you create your films, you have to kind of inhabit somebody else's skin. So in some ways, we, you know, as creative people, you can become Malay or any character that you want in order to kind of realize that in an imaginative sense, right?
I mean, I think so, yes. I think you have a responsibility to try and understand as much as possible about your characters. You know, in order to write effectively and as accurately as you can.
Okay, now you at the festival, you're going to be performing, and music is often the kind of tail end of the festival day. It is the come and relax, but not all music is about relaxing. It does also require some focus. Yours is satirical, so it's funny and entertaining, but it's also thoughtful. Tell us about your music.
Well, you know, I write in both languages, and I'm trying to actually write a lot
more.
Was
it Tamil and English?
English and Malay, right. Yeah. Okay. And I'm actually trying to explore the Malay language more, especially the way it's spoken and how we can incorporate spoken Malay into music, because not many people do that. I mean, I think the film industry is quick to catch on in incorporating spoken, and the writers are, but the musicians still speak in this, in the Baku, in the classic Malay, and I'm not sure who they're singing to. Maybe they're singing to Anwar Ibrahim. But the thing is, I think that there are a few of us, like Azmil Yunus, for example, and we're trying to actually explore just conversational Malay and how we can incorporate that into music, because it has different rhythmic properties than the classic Malay language.
Is this true of film, though? I mean, what kind of Malay is spoken in film? And you've created a lot of rom-coms or romantic comedies.
Our very first film, Godan Ginchu, in 2005, was sort of referred to as a sort of landmark film in terms of the language. And I must say, all we did was we were true to characters. We were true to the characters in that sort of, yes, I would say quite KL, quite urban, but we were also inspired by Indonesia's Ada Apa Dengan Cinta, and they had this idea of Bahasa Gaul, which was very Jakarta. It's Jakarta
Bahasa
speak.
Bahasa Gaul. Gaul being like conversational chatting.
So that, you know, conversational Malay, a conversational language. And we adopted that into a film, and after that, when we did that in 2005, it was a landmark film that became a television series. Then everyone else from then on sort of said, yes, you know, urban characters, urban films should have that clarity and that genuine voice. But I myself, as a Malaysian film director, inadvertently, I don't know how it happened, but somehow along the way, I've become a Malaysian director whose most successful films are in the Malay language. So in that sense, you know, just now it was uncanny that I was listening to Malay and translating it into English, because in a way, the scripts that we write, the stage directions is in English, but the dialogue is in Malay or true to the characters. But I think that this is a wonderful country to work with all sorts of
multiplicity.
Challenges.
Okay, very quickly, your last assessment: you're here as a musician, and you're here as a filmmaker, picking up stories, because literary festivals are all about people and their stories. Picked up any interesting stories, you?
This literally the first panel that I've been for. I just arrived yesterday, but it always is. I mean, festivals always, there are places where you go and you just meet people and learn a lot more about what people are thinking about, especially current issues. I think they always have a way of cropping up, as has happened over the yesterday and day before. So yeah.
But what about you? I mean,
all sorts. I mean, even this morning for me started with partition, the Indian partition, and there was a question on the floor. something like the partition, you know, have all the stories been written? And there was an interesting question, you know, like all the stories are negative experiences of the partition. One question was like, you know, have there been positive stories, you know, of how, say, Hindus protected Muslims in this partition? So, you know, it was just interesting for me to think about it, because in a way, I'm actually drawn to the past as well as the present, not really future. I'm not drawn to anything sci-fi, and thankfully this does not have any sci-fi element. So historical stories that are relevant in the contemporary space, I think I'll continue to think about that.
Right, wonderful. Thank you so much, Bernard, Brian, for being on the show.
Cheers.
Next up, I have Michael Vatikiotis, a well-known journalist and writer. We're still at the Georgetown Literary Festival. Stay with me. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. We're at the Georgetown Literary Festival in Penang. This is one of the venues for many of the discussions that we held over the weekend. State of Freedom, that is the theme for the Georgetown Literary Festival. We had here over the weekend Anwar Ibrahim speaking to a very interested crowd about his ideas on liberalism, on the LGBT community and politics in Malaysia. But now I'm going to speak to Michael Vatikiotis. He's a journalist and also author of short stories, as well as a recent work on Southeast Asian politics. I'm going to ask him about the value of history. Michael, the question of history has come up at the festival. You involved in a panel discussion on the Indian partition. That's more than half a century ago. Why is history important?
I think it's particularly important in Asia because in so many ways, the histories of many of these countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, and also India, tend to get obscured or buried or deliberately sidelined for political reasons. It's too difficult, it's awkward, lots of people died, let's move on, let's forget about the past. And my argument is that you can't forget about the past. There's no addressing grievances if the past is buried. So I think it's very important at festivals like this that history is recovered. And very often it's through writers and artists and poets that actually the history is being transmitted. You know, I think artists and writers are the conductor rails of history in countries where history is too difficult for governments, for education systems to actually put before students. So it is very important.
Right, so you're a journalist, but you also do fictional work and imaginative work. What is the relationship between the hard facts that journalists go after and the kind of imagination that goes behind works of fiction, you think, when it comes to history?
Well, I think that very often journalists find it difficult because history tends to be background. And as a journalist, you want a story. So your history is relegated to the introductory or down story sort of context. Whereas the artist, the writer, the poet can actually put history at the center of an imagined reality. And so it's actually, I think, easier for the novelist than it is for the journalist. The journalist can sort of recover bits of history as they sort of crumble away, but I think it's the novelist that does a very good job. The problem is it's inadequate. I mean, a novelist will take a slice of history and doesn't provide the entire context. So you need properly narrated history. And that has to come to us through the education system, through books and academic studies, which are very often not adequate and not adequately provided for, simply because it's too sensitive. Many of these histories are still raw. They are less than 100 years. They are just two generations away. And I think that's difficult, particularly in Malaysia, Indonesia, because of the things that happened in the past, and they involved racial conflict.
You know, one of the panelists that you had when you moderated a session on the Indian partition was Salil Tripathi, who's written a book on the Bangladesh War of Liberation from 1971. And today, even today, people are being prosecuted for the war crimes of the past. I mean, just 40 years or, well, coming up to 50 years ago now. The way that history impinges on the present in Southeast Asia, and that's an area that you've covered for decades now, is it still an important issue? Can you think of an issue or two that still animates the current politics.
Yes, I mean, if you look at Indonesia today, there is still a very strong movement against communists. Of course, communism is long dead, and many communists died in 1965, and the relatives, the victims, would still like to see their grievance addressed. But yet there is still a very virulent conservative reaction to the idea that somehow communism would be revived. And I think that's an example of how history is being suppressed in the interests of power. Very often these prejudices are because someone is using and exploiting these divisions in order to obtain power.
Michael, last question for you. You've been at this festival for years now. How do you feel about it? It's grown, it's huge now. It was in the past, as you experienced it, quite a small, intimate affair. Now it's quite big. Do you think it's a wonderful trajectory, or do you think that's going to be a problem for them in the future?
I think the very important thing about the festival is not just the festival itself, but where it's held in Penang, which is a sort of bastion of liberal values in not just Malaysia, but in Southeast Asia. I think it's also very important that it's transitioning through a moment in Malaysian history where there's a great desire for people to express themselves. And I think it's important, finally, that the festival is also about issues and not about the big names and the people who perform. It's about I think Bernice does a very good job of maintaining a consistent theme, which not a lot of other festivals do.
Thank you so much, John.
Okay, Shah. Great. Thank you.
Coming up next, I have Punky Tek, a co-curator at the Georgetown Literary Festival, and Louise Welsh was a participant in one of his panels. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk with me, Shirai Kutin. We're still at the Georgetown Literary Festival, and my next guests are Punky Tek, co-curator of the festival, as well as Louise Welsh. Pang, Louise, thank you so much for joining me. Pang, you're a curator, one of several curators at the festival. What were you trying to bring to the festival? What kind of conversations are you interested?
Well, my role was basically to bring the queer discussions and also to invite a few of the queer writers that I know from both Malaysia as well as around the world. Though quite a number of the queer writers who were invited are actually people that a context of the festival director, Bernice.
Louise, you come from Scotland. Tell us, why are you here? Who brought you here? And what is your purpose? You have a nefarious purpose.
I was invited here by the festival, and I was sponsored by Creative Scotland, who's a funding body in Scotland. And as soon as I got the invitation, I was just like, yes, of course I want to come to this festival. Of course I want to discuss freedom. And I think, looking at Scotland, we have a lot of hard-won rights, and we have been told exactly the same thing, and on occasion are still told the same things. Oh yeah, of course, you know, yeah, we're told, when you said yeah, it's okay to be out, but please don't go on about it. This is something people across the world are told, and I think one of the reasons that it's important that we talk is not only so we can recognize each other and have the discourse with each other, but by being out, other people see us, and then they become less afraid, because what do they see? They see us, you know? It's fine, we're not frightening. They see a middle-aged woman who's been with the same partner for 18 years, who collects her neighbor's newspaper every morning, who, you know, all of these things. And I think invisibility is not our friend. Being out and being open and discussing, and mothers, fathers, neighbors, children, teachers then become less afraid of queerness. It is nothing to be afraid of.
You know, one of the things, of course, this is a literary festival. It builds itself as a literary festival. The intersection between the political discourse of the conversations and the literary and artistic ones, where do they come together in what you've curated for the festival park?
Well, I think in the arts and in literature, there are opportunities to be vague, to be tested, to be, to play with visibility. I think a lot of queer people understand that kind of existence, playing with spectrality, being a phantom, being visible, haunting corridors. And I think some people may want to have may want to be less visible. And I think that should be a choice as well. But the problem, I think, is we don't have that choice. A lot of people feel that being less visible is the only choice, and I don't think they can make that choice. So I think creating a platform for being able to bring in the arts as a medium of expressing, as a medium of playing with modes of visibility, enriches our understanding of queer lives and the kind of tension and struggles that we live through on a daily basis.
Louise, you write short stories and such. Tell us a little bit about the creative intersection with the political, if you can.
Yeah, I write in many forms. I've written 8 novels, I've written plays, I've written libretti for opera, and each of those forms has its own requirements. But the thing that ties them all together is that they are always political, because to live is to be political. I have the freedom, I can state whatever I want within my fiction. It may not get published, but I can say whatever I want. But I think back to my predecessors at the University of Glasgow, and I think to the poet Edwin Morgan, a wonderful poet who lived again with his husband, we would say now, who could not be open, and his poems are this beautiful ambiguity that you talk about. So sometimes, yeah, within literature, we can do all sorts of things. We can be open, we can speak quietly, we can speak loudly, but it's always political.
I mean, and how does that work for you here in the kinds of people? Louise is just one of many people who have come to have the conversations that you've been curating. Tell us about the others.
So actually, this is the perfect place to go into that conversation that I'm very much looking forward to, called "Are the Arts Just Bigger Closets?" And you know, because after taking down my photos, the festival director who complied with the wishes of the government went on to say that he chose to lose his battle for the sake of the bigger picture of the arts in Penang. And on one hand, what I found very disturbing about that is it wasn't his battle to lose. You know what I mean? This was my battle. The moment you put up my photo, you put up my story, it's my battle there, and you have to consult me before you do anything about my battle. Now, and on the other hand, what does the bigger picture now include if it does not include us? Are you prescribing that for LGBT people or for queer voices to exist in the arts, we can only ever be subtle? Is that not a kind of closet you're putting us back in again?
Okay, so back to my question earlier, who else have you brought into this conversation apart from Louise?
So we have some Malaysians, and I think for the Malaysians, I cannot out them. Some of them still live on that kind of they're treading, right? Selective outness.
The others that you've invited?
I've invited William Young from Australia, who is one of my favorite writer, and he's a performer. He writes about being gay and being Chinese and being discriminated for both in Australia. We've invited Cyril Wong, who is a gay poet who is openly HIV positive from Singapore. We've invited
Joanna Cruz from the Philippines, and Ivan Coyote from Canada.
Yukon.
Okay, Louise, in your encounters at the festival, and I imagine you go to many festivals, I presume you do, how different is the Georgetown Festival for you?
I think that it's very challenging. I think that some of the programming is challenging and leads to really good and genuine discussions, and discussions that I haven't experienced at other festivals. So I think when I go home, and I hope you don't mind, I might steal some of the titles. But yes, I think we're having good, challenging, and always, and this is the thing about the arts, always kind of respectful conversations. You know, that we can disagree. We can disagree quite strongly, but we do it within a framework, or not a framework, within an atmosphere of tolerance and openness.
Louise, is this the first time that you've been to Malaysia or the region?
It's the first time that I've been to Malaysia. I've been to Singapore some years ago.
And any first impressions about the conversations that you've been plugging into here?
Yeah, I think, as I said, that openness, and for me, I think part of my job here is to listen, really. You know, I was on this panel, but I think really what I want to do is open my ears and hear what people have to say and think about that and discover new literature. And I came with some books and I thought, that's great. I'll get rid of the books I brought and then I'll have a really light case. But actually now my case is heavier than when I arrived because they've got a great bookshop here and great writers that I haven't encountered before and great anthologies and magazines and journals. And so I'm going home with more. And that is the thing about a festival, that you come with some ideas and you leave with more ideas and more texts. And I'll be taking that back to Scotland.
And anything of note, Pang, in terms of writing, in terms of magazines, when it comes to the queer question in Malaysia, is there much of that happening?
I think we have a few prominent queer writers, including Regina Ibrahim, one of the most prominent trans writers in Malaysia, who is quite prolific, I think, putting out books. And she chose to always write in Malay because that's her audience. And we have collections, I think, of queer stories being anthologized within other anthologies. I think for now, a lot of us put up with that because that's one of the ways we insert ourselves into the larger discourse, you know. We find ourselves in non-exclusively queer anthologies. However, tonight, Matahari Books is launching a Malay book called Kisah Orang Kita, penulisan LGBT oleh LGBT, LGBT writing by LGBT people.
Okay, thank you very much for joining me in the show.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you for this episode. We've been at the Georgetown Literary Festival in Penang. We'll bring you more. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with Mishra Adkitten, only on Astro One.